Welcome to Home Health Revealed, where we share real stories from industry leaders about home health, palliative, and hospice care. Brought to you by Velocity. Grow your home health or hospice agency with the power of Velocity. Velocity's easy-to-read coding and revenue cycle dashboards let you grab your cup of coffee and quickly see the health of your organization.
All right, welcome to Home Health Revealed podcast. I'm your host, Mike Greenlee, and I've got the great Hannah Vale with me today. Hannah, what is happening?
Hey, drinking coffee. Round two.
How many cups you had so far?
I think this is five.
Okay. All right. Well, we got a great topic today, but before we get into the topic, I got a couple questions to see your knowledge on. Do you know the real difference between a million and a billion? You ready for this? Now, as you know, our government, they throw out money like it grows on trees, right? And so you hear all the time on TV, we gave a million here, we gave a billion there. And most people don't know how to separate the two. Right? Because they just seem like we just throw that out there, right? One's got an M, one's got a B, but that's not it. So here's the question. You ready? Do you need to pray about it or anything? You ready? You
should. Yeah, probably. I probably do.
All right. Okay. So here's the question. How many seconds are in a million? Or a million? No, sorry. Scratch that. Let me start over. Make sure you erase that.
Okay.
All right. A million seconds is how many days?
Oh, goodness.
What would you think?
I mean, can I do the math? Can I have a scrap piece of paper?
Nope.
Jot it down.
Should I? And Cheryl, you can participate as well. How many million seconds is how many days? You guys give your best guess.
It's got to be like 800 days, I'm thinking.
Okay, 800 days.
Well, I don't think it could be that many because you've got 60 seconds. You've got 60 seconds in each minute.
You've got 60 minutes in each hour.
So then you've got times 24. Uh-uh. So it's got to be like.
You cannot be criticizing her guess when you haven't even shot anything out yet.
It's a little less than 2 weeks.
So you're saying 14 days.
Sure. I'll give you 14 days.
Okay. It's 11 days.
Oh, crap. I'm way out there.
Now, how many days is a billion seconds?
I'll hold my answer. It's 800.
Okay. So.
Oh yeah. Are you?
I have
really
to have my scrap piece of paper.
Oh my goodness. Kay? Just guess. What do you think? For priming it, like.
It's got to be about 110.
31 years.
What? All right. Clearly, I don't know the difference between a million and a billion.
Now, but wow. Does that not put that into perspective?
Yeah, it does.
31 years. That's crazy.
Ugh, so anyway, I
heard that on a podcast with Joe Rogan and I thought I'd steal it because I thought it was amazing. Cause I guessed 100 and some odd days on the first one. And I didn't even think about years on the second one.
I was still on days in my mind.
Well, anyway, I appreciate you guys playing that game with me. I thought it was interesting. No one comes close. You actually came pretty close on the million seconds. Hannah, that's pretty good. Cheryl, not so good.
Yeah, no, terrible.
Welcome. Welcome to Home Health Revealed.
Yeah, that's right. Welcome to the crew. All right. Hannah, what we got today?
So we have a great show today. We have Cheryl Lovell with us today. And I'm gonna read her bio because it's pretty impressive. And I only just got it this morning. So, Cheryl, did
ChatGPT do your bio? Have you ever had ChatGPT do your bio?
I've not had it do my bio, but I've had it do a couple of other things for me over the last couple of weeks. And I am very nervous and impressed because it is quite dynamic.
Okay. All right. We've had it do ours. And let me tell you, I sounded really good.
Cheryl is a driving force behind remarkable changes to company direction and operational solvency. Engaging and articulate communicator. She has 25 years of accomplishments within the post-acute care space. She achieves dramatic results and inspires team members to excel. She is a dynamic leader who has been progressively responsible for business management, business development, marketing, and employee engagement. She has a proven track record in financial management, new business development, technological implementation of programs, and strategic planning. She has an incredible ability to reach diverse populations for business growth. She has detailed knowledge of state and federal regulations governing hospitals, home health, clinics, and residential programs. She has a proven ability to run successful programs based on external audits, including CHAP, CMS, JCO, DHS, and EEO surveys. With a strong track record of generating revenue, increasing referrals, implementing cost-saving measures, and employee satisfaction, she is committed to team building and personnel training and development. She is a skilled visionary in planning and implementing new ideas, programs, and innovations.
Well, you'd think with somebody with that bio that we'd be asking some real tough questions. However, what doesn't say in that bio, and I got the opportunity to talk with Cheryl a few weeks back, she's got a great personality. And so I wanted to have her on the podcast today to share a little bit of, you know, what she's been through and just share a little bit more about her, but she's got a great personality, but we're not really going to drill so much into all that expertise, even though that is fantastic, Cheryl. You know, 25 years, everything that you know in the business, congratulations. That's awesome.
Thank you guys.
But we are going to take you down a different path today. You ready for this?
Yeah, we've titled this, let's tell them the title, Mike, because I think this is going to be really fun. The wild, the weird, and the wonderful. So gleaning from all of her experience, we're going to get some real stories that Cheryl is going to be able to tell us from her home health perspective. So.
All right, here we go. Cheryl, this is my first three questions. They're tough. You ready?
Yep.
Cheryl, if home health had a theme song, what would it be and why?
The good, the bad, and the ugly. And because it's all of those things all wrapped up into one.
That's actually a really good answer. I stopped myself on that. I was like, I don't know what I'd say on that. All right. Have you ever had a moment where you thought, they didn't teach me this in business school?
Oh, every day. I don't think anybody teaches anybody Medicare in business school because you're taught logic and data and facts. And unfortunately, Medicare is illogical. The regulations are not factual and they are not applied consistently or logically across the continuum.
All right. Now, if you could give your CEO superpower, if you had a CEO superpower, what would it be?
Being able to see all the floating pieces of the puzzle in front of me and seeing how they can fit in weird, wild, and unique ways, since I'm going to go with the title of the, you know, the podcast here, but it's really being able to see the pieces floating in front of me and what are the different opportunities I have to put them together and where does it make the most sense, and challenging people around me to see those floating pieces and that they have the ability to be manipulated and put together in a multitude of ways. And from a good friend of mine, is it style versus substance? So do I care what the style is or do I care about the substance of the content?
That's good.
You think she would score, give her like a 30 on that? Like at 10 out of 10 out of 10. I mean, she did pretty good.
She did great.
Yeah.
That was a good way to analyze that. Cheryl, what's one piece of advice you wish someone would have given you before jumping into post-acute leadership?
Adult babysitting is okay.
Ooh, what do you mean by that?
I think a lot of, and I've heard this many, many times, many of the people we work with in the post-acute care have advanced degrees, graduate degrees, master's degrees, PhDs, et cetera. And everybody makes the assumption coming in when you're leading grown-up adults with advanced degrees, that they behave in a way that you would expect them to when you're a leader. And oftentimes, they just act like people with flaws and immaturity and lack of skills that you make assumptions about. And I think you have to go in not assuming that everybody, just because you're a particular type of leader or have an expectation, that not everybody meets that. And I often find myself saying to people, you have to meet people where they are, and you can't expect everybody to be like you or think like you, or there would be no need for any leaders in the world.
Yeah, I totally agree with that. What kind of books do you read?
I read a lot of business books. Like, I'm a huge fan of Lencioni. Like, his storytelling ability at the beginning of any of his lessons, I think, are always good. I really enjoy The Ideal Team Player. I mean, everybody in their life has to read How to Win Friends and Influence People at least one time. Like, I made my kids read that when they were in the eighth grade, and I thought that they thought I was torturing them. But can I tell a little personal story?
Yeah, please do.
So my son is 22. He's in the culinary world. He's working in a restaurant as a chef and assistant chef or whatever. He's very young. And he left his job and then found a different job and came back to his job that he had left because he realized how good he had it. And it was over a pretty short period of time, a couple of months. And so yesterday he called me at 22 and said, "Mom, I'm meeting with my boss today. I've been back 3 weeks and I want to ask him some questions like, what are the goals of the restaurant? What are the goals that you have for me? What did you need me to change when I came back, et cetera?" And I honestly believe it's because I made him do things at a very young age, like read those kind of books and engage in interpersonal skills. And so communication skills are key. And the fact that at 22, he can articulate himself in a way that makes him valuable to an organization. And they obviously welcomed him back with open arms and said, you know, everybody has to kind of explore a little bit. But the fact that he can articulate himself and be able to move himself forward, it's just, I think we're lacking in teaching people these days who go into the workforce how you need to be a better part of a team.
Yeah, totally agree with that.
I do too. And I love that story.
Yeah, one of the books I'm reading right now is the 80-20 CEO, the CEO 80-20 rule, something like that. That may not be the right title. My wife says I'm dyslexic. I was like, no, I'm not. She's like, yeah, you are. And so I had to find proof that if I was actually pretty smart. You know, most dyslexic people, this is true. It's on the internet. It's on the Google, right? It said right. That most dyslexic people, or if they even suffer from ADD, which everybody in the world thinks I suffer from that, because I'll just bounce all over the place. They say 85% of them, I think it's 85%. Now I'm making up a statistic, but like most of them are entrepreneurs. And because of those shortfalls, what some people would see them as shortfalls, it actually, we think totally different. We're more strategic, visionary type thinkers, which I thought that was very interesting. So, you know, you look at one thing, which people say, oh, you're dyslexic because you have ADD, which again, self-diagnosed and my wife diagnosed me. But then you look at the flip side of it and there's, you know, there's good. And so I just thought that was interesting.
Yeah, I bet the stat is 85% of entrepreneurs have ADD.
Maybe that's it.
I bet it is.
Yeah.
Because I think my son has it a little bit. I think I suffer from like being all over the place, but I don't do well being bored. And it's funny because like I have a full-time job and like at least 25 side projects, but I can get them all in because I need something to do. My mind has to be constantly moving in order for me to feel good, right? Like it's just super important that I've got something going and I need a problem to solve. I have to be able to, I need something to solve. I need something to fix. I need a problem.
Yeah. Now do you sleep good at night?
I sleep excellent. Okay. I sleep like a baby.
So you can shut it off then.
Oh yeah. But I train myself. Like when I was very early in my career, I did staffing for a small home care agency. It was really a national home care, Kelly Assisted Living, the Kelly Girl people. And I did staffing. This was like in the early 90s when I was first in this business. And I would wake up in the middle of the night. Oh my God, did I call that client or did I fix this schedule problem or whatever? And I trained myself. This is before smartphones, all the things, to put a little notepad next to my bed. So when I woke up, I wrote it down and then I went right back to sleep. Otherwise, I would try to remember this till the morning and then I wouldn't sleep, right? So I trained myself early in my life to put it away. And so the longer, the older I got and the more things and the more I grew, I was able to learn at bedtime to put it away so that I didn't wake myself up with those types of thoughts. So I think it was just my own, I had to solve my own problem somehow. And there wasn't a lot of resources out there. The big Google machine in 1997 wasn't what it is today. So I had to figure it out myself. And I thought, I'm not going to keep myself up every night trying to remember what I should have done during the day that woke me up in the middle of the night. Right. So I just wrote it down on a piece of paper. Now I will voice record or do something else. If I am woken up with something, which is not often anymore, but if I am, I will do something.
Do you find too, that if you are problem solving or you're passionate about what you're doing, you can hyper-focus for a long period of time?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yep. That's also indicative of
the
ADD
whole process.
Or,
yeah.
Yeah.
I don't know. I just love my big, beautiful, crazy brain. That's all. It's crazy.
Well, I definitely don't think it is I don't think it's a handicap.
No.
I think
no,
in our world, we just don't give space for the ability to, one, focus for long periods of time. We've trained, and this goes back to our education system, but we've trained bell ringing 45 to 47 minutes on task, moving along thing to thing, as opposed to letting people long-term think, long-term problem solve, focus on an entire thought process. We've done that to ourselves, and we find that kids now are less empathetic. They lack emotional intelligence because they don't have that creative play. They don't have the time and space to do those things.
Yeah.
Boy, we have gotten off topic a little bit, but not really, actually.
Not really.
Because we are still talking about problem solving. So
that's right.
The next question, are you a MacGyver fan?
Back in the day, yeah.
Okay. So we're thinking duct tape, rubber bands, just that 100%. Pure determination, grit that it takes to get stuff done sometimes. But have you ever had to MacGyver a solution in the field? And tell us about that.
Do you know, so I'm not a clinician by trade, right? I was a corpsman in the military, but I ended up going to business school and have healthcare administration background and business background. And I'll tell you my biggest MacGyver lesson or whatever. I'm sort of grateful that I wasn't a clinician back in the day, because I would have solved my own problems instead of having to find solutions for the problems, to get appropriate staff to do things, instead of, because I was a clinician, just to go do it myself. So my biggest lessons that I had to MacGyver was I had to be the most creative, the most strategic and determined, because I couldn't just go out there and do the visit when I had to find someone to say yes, right? So I really think that is where my grit and determination comes from, because there was no easy band-aid for me. I couldn't. And I see a lot of young business owners in home health who are the nurse and who they open their own home health, and they end up burning themselves out because they're the solution to their own problems, because they were never forced to have to find the solution, because they could just go do the visit. So if you could just go do the visit, when do you have time to solve the problem and actually create a bigger opportunity?
Yeah.
What is the strangest excuse a patient or family is given for missing an appointment?
I think my favorite is when they say, I can't have an appointment because I'm sick. And we're like, that's why we're supposed to be there. Like, you can't call out sick from your clinician coming to give you a sick visit. Like, I think that's just my favorite. It's not the strangest thing I've ever heard, but it is the consistent thing that makes me laugh all the time, because they're like, I don't feel good today. And I've trained my team to say, that's why we're coming, because you don't feel good. We're supposed to be there when you don't feel good, not when you feel good. So that is common. But the strangest thing I think I ever heard, oh God, that's really a tough one. Honestly, like, you have the homebound patient who's supposed to be at home and they are, you know, at the casino, you know, fun things like that. Like, oh, I just took the bus to the casino, honey. I'm not going to make my appointment today. Well, you know, that's probably a problem, Betty, but we'll see what happens later. So, you know, but there's always lots of fun excuses.
I used to like to use the excuse that I didn't feel good to go to church. And my mom would be like, well, then there's no better place for you to be.
Right.
Yeah, exactly. Get healed.
Exactly.
That's right.
Exactly. Okay. Next question here. What's one home health myth you wish we could debunk forever?
That just because a person drives themselves to the doctor means they're not homebound.
Okay. All right. That's a good one. So let's talk a little bit about leadership. Let's shift gears here. A little leadership, a little industry perspective. What's a leadership lesson that you had to learn the hard way?
So I started my career out in the military. And so in the military, when you're a leader, and I was a leader very early in the military, I grew my rank pretty quickly. I only stayed in for 4 years, but pretty fast was a leader in the military. And I think that's just the nature of the beast, right? That's just who I'm as a person. But in my first job outside the military, go back to the Kelly girl people, and I was running a home care agency. I got called by my boss, because I guess my employees were complaining because I didn't ask them to do things. I told them to do things. And she's like, you're not in the military anymore, Cheryl. You have to ask someone to go to work. And I'm like, but don't we pay them a salary? Like, don't we pay them money to do their job? We aren't just supposed to say, you go to your client and this is what you do. And she's like, no, honey, you really have to ask them and get their buy-in. And I just didn't get it, right? Like, I was like, okay. So Maybe a couple months later, she called me back. She goes, you're the only employee that I've ever given like recommendations to where there was something wrong that actually listened to me and like made a change. And so, I obviously am able to follow directions, especially when a boss gives them to you and says, you know, change your perspective. And I did. And I think I went a little bit more on the salesy side because I could get these people to do anything for me because now I learned the art of, you know, sales and manipulation, sort of, you know, like you got to give a little to get more. And so I was able to balance the burden a lot. And even to this day, I guess my best advice as a leader is if you can't take advice yourself, you're always growing and learning. There is no way any of us are perfect. Every one of us needs to be humbled and said, you know, you could have done that better. Maybe during that meeting, you should have talked less and listened more or whatever. If you can't do that, then you're going to struggle forever because there is no way that we all don't need to grow and learn on any given day.
Good point. Good point. I had always had to learn that, like when I get an email and I don't like it, normally I'd want to respond, which is never really good. Nothing ever good comes out of that, right? So now I sleep on it. And what I have found is that the next morning when I read that email again, I'm like, that really wasn't that big of a deal. So that's kind of some of the things that I've learned. So
now if I send him an email and I don't get him back that same day, I know it made him mad.
Oh, quit it.
That's awesome.
Put it out. Remember that?
Yeah.
What was that?
From Full House.
Full House.
Joey Gladstone, aka Dave Coulier.
That's right.
Oh, that poor man has cancer right now, doesn't he? He has like brain cancer or something. Yeah, so sad. Prayers for Dave.
If you could change one thing about the post-acute world overnight, what would you change?
The ability for all of the unique service lines like nursing homes, assisted living, hospice, home health, to understand that they all need each other and that they should be interdependent instead of independently focused. I still think we have not won the war on we are all unique care settings. No, we are all a continued care setting and we have to rely on each other and support each other. Treating each other like vendor relationships is the worst thing that ever happened with all of the Stark Law violations and all of those things, because we no longer believe that we're all on the same team and we need to feel and believe that we're on the same team in order to get the best outcome from the patient. And that is probably the worst thing that's ever happened in our industry, that we became vendors instead of care partners.
That is so, so true. Amen to that.
Well, it seems like kind of like that was the deal with like healthcare. Remember, like, you know, the hospitals weren't really connected. So you go one, they wouldn't know. And then you get all these tests and then, you know, driving up costs and so forth. Yeah, I totally agree with that. What's the one thing home health and hospice providers do that absolutely drive you crazy?
Treat the patient as a thing that they have to fight over. Right. Like, so there's always going to be competition in every industry or whatever. The thing that makes me the most crazy is when a provider fights with another provider over a patient. Like, you should be doing what's in the best interest of the patient, no matter what happens and whether you win or lose. If you're picking your team to be the winner, did the patient really win? Like, why are we fighting over a patient? Like, what is their choice? What is the reality? Are we racing to the door to be the first one there? And we don't have a relationship and someone else, like, it's just that inner fighting about fighting over a patient. You should never be fighting over a patient. You should be just helping the patient decide what's in their best interest. And they should never be put in the middle of providers fighting over who a patient belongs to.
Now, you mentioned earlier that you do a lot of things. You full-time job, you got 25 things on the side. What's your go-to for stress relief after a tough day? What is it that you do?
Oh gosh, you really don't want to know. I really enjoy wine.
What kind of wine? What's your favorite wine?
Oh, criminy. Like, I really like great Cabernets that are really, you know, I'm a bold kind of red wine girl. I like a few Chardonnays, but I really like a big red wine is always like preferable. Big Italian red, just big reds. But I grew up into that. But it's funny because my husband's a huge bourbon guy and I've never been, but I'm really trying to learn bourbon. So recently I have been branching out and trying some different bourbons and learning that bourbon is really about what it tastes like afterwards, not what it tastes like going in. So I'm really learning to appreciate, you know, some different ventures.
Now, are we talking one glass of wine, two, or are we doing the whole bottle?
I'm on a couple glasses. On a tough day, could be a bottle, but on any given day, maybe a glass or two. It's not an everyday thing, but certainly I enjoy my wine.
Yeah, it's funny. You remember that skit? I think it was on SNL or whatever, with the guys going to the doctor and he's asking him all the questions. How many drinks do you have per day? And he's like, you know, do you want me to tell you the truth? He's like, yeah. And he's like, well, 15 or whatever he says. And he goes, and then the doctor something says about beer. And he's like, oh, well, you're counting beer too?
Exactly.
That was funny.
Well, I want to move us into the wonderful and the heartwarming, because there is a lot of that in the post-acute space. But Cheryl, can you share a patient story that truly stuck with you and reminded you about why you do this work?
Yeah, I'm going to go in the Wayback Machine. So in the early 90s, when I was first in this industry, after I got out of the military, I couldn't get a job in anything else except for being a nursing assistant, right? A bedside home health aide, CNA. And I worked for a hospice, and I worked in Oregon at the time. And I had a patient who was very young, who was dying alone of lymphatic cancer. And she didn't have any friends or family around her. And she requested that I would be the only person who would be there, especially when she passed, because I was the overnight caregiver. And I ended up spending like several days in a row with her until she passed away. And it was just a sad story. It was before alternative lifestyles were sort of acceptable. There was just so many things in this baggage background that I just was the person who I knew I could be there and be the comfort that she needed, because she really didn't have anybody and nobody really understood her. She was in her 30s. It was a very unfortunate situation, but it's why you get out of bed every day, because you know you're making a difference in someone's life. And that was so monumental to me.
Yeah. What's the smallest act of kindness you've seen from a caregiver or clinician that made a huge impact?
You know what? It's all, and I've seen these a million times over, it's always food, right? Like, there's always a small act of kindness in relation to someone wanting something very specific, especially towards the end of their life. It's like, did I bring them a root beer float, or did I, you know, give them their favorite deli sandwich, or did I bring them their last favorite beer, or whatever it is? It's always something that brings back a memory, but it's typically always related around food. And I've done a ton of last wishes, like so many times, like just getting a patient on a fishing boat for their last time, no matter how hard the effort was, it's so worth doing. So it's always those small acts of kindness. You can't put a price on those. And it's always usually something super small. It's the milkshake. It's the favorite soup. It's the root beer float. It's always something. And it doesn't have to be big. It's just that little act of kindness.
Well, I was just going to ask you, Cheryl, I'm interested, you know, with all the investigating we're doing into the government and the wasteful spending, not to get political on any spectrum, but, you know, we're finding out that Medicare itself was sending a ton of money over there. And then you guys are held to such strict regulations with Medicare and reimbursement. You know, when you hear that, you know, as somebody that's been in this business for several years, that has a lot of passion for this business, but just tell me what goes through your mind when you hear stuff like that on the news.
You know, I've had this conversation many years, and before even the government's looking into it the way it is right now. And what always fascinates me, and we talk about this on a national platform all the time, the people who are committing fraud, no matter what rules you put in place, no matter what audits you do, whatever, they're still going to commit fraud because they're making things up. It's the tryhards that have to suffer from all of the takebacks. Like, you're going to you're going to pull back $50,000, $60,000 from a small hospice because, in your opinion, the person didn't meet medical necessity or whatever. That's your opinion. That's not what actually the facts are and whatever. Because the people who are doing fraud, their notes are perfect. They don't actually exist. The patients are fake. The things are fake. So you don't actually prevent fraud by adding more rules and making it more complicated to take care of people. You just teach the fraudsters how to do better fraud. And they, so they just do better fraud and they're not really catchable. Like, it's, people are not, there's just not so many super nefarious people who are, if they're doing fraud, they're doing fraud and that's their game, who are actually trying to run legitimate businesses and do legitimate work. When you show up and you do the surveys and you meet the people and you see how hard the clinicians are working, I really think that what Medicare should do, if they're going to say that you have to have a targeted probe and educate, that they have to get in the car and go out with the clinician who's seeing that patient and tell them what they're doing isn't right before you can just read a piece of paper and determine that patient doesn't qualify for home health or hospice based on medical necessity. Get in the car and tell that patient no, that they don't qualify.
Yeah.
That's where I think the rubber misses the road.
Yeah. Last question here. I'm just very interested. How many times through your career as you're building agencies and everything you've done, how many times have you wanted to quit?
Oh, wow. Sometimes I would say every day. Sometimes I would say, why did I choose this such a hard profession? Why can't I be in a profession that makes 70% margins and nobody's crapping their pants over that the answering service didn't answer the phone or the nurse got back 17 minutes later instead of 15 minutes later? Like, no matter how high you are up in leadership in any organization, you feel those things all the time. Like, you know, when you're one of your agencies isn't performing at its best, or you have an employee satisfaction issue or a patient satisfaction issue, you just want to be able to fix it all. So you're just personally, I don't think you can be in this if your heart isn't in it and you don't feel affected when something goes wrong, because it does all the time. We're dealing with humans who are taking care of humans who are sick and tired of being sick and tired.
Yeah. No, I just love to hear it, because I don't think people realize that there's, you know, it's a journey, right? And and in that journey, you go through seasons. And then right. You got people that go through seasons. And yeah. It is one of the most difficult things to do, is to continue to, you mentioned grit before, and just keep driving forward. It takes a special person to be able to do that, but it doesn't mean that at times you don't think about quitting, because it does, you know, it gets really hard on you.
Exactly. It does. And every little thing matters. Every company that you've either worked with, own, ran, whatever, the bottom line is you have to put the patient at the center of your decision-making and all the things work out. But when you lose that focus, you struggle.
Yeah.
Can't be about profit margins. It can't be about, you know, anything else. It has to be, are we taking care of that patient where they need to be taken care of? And are we doing the right things in the rule pieces that we have put around us?
Yeah. Well, sure. I appreciate you so much spending time with us, being open to be on the podcast.
Yeah, this was great. I'm happy to do it. I love this.
I love when people get to hear somebody from your experience and get to hear some of the stories, and really appreciate you being humble and transparent. It was excellent. I really enjoyed having this conversation.
Well, I really appreciate you guys. Thank you.
Oh, a last question.
Yeah.
If some of our listeners would want to get in touch with you, connect with you. Can they do that? And if so, how would they do that?
Yeah, the Cheryl@clcgroupco.com. And then you could put my cell phone number on there. It's totally fine. I think you got, it's the 480-313-9250.
Perfect. Okay.
Okay.
Well, hey, all right, guys, stay warm. Thank you. Have a great rest of your week.
To you the rest of the year. Thank you so much for being on, and we'll talk soon.
Take care. Thanks, guys. Right. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.